Chapter 5. In 1972, John and I moved out of London to Virginia Water in Surrey, swapping the one-bedroom flat for something a little more grand. We bought a three-bedroom bungalow with its own swimming pool and a games room built in what had been the loft. I called it Hercules to match my middle name. Bernie and Maxine, who had married in 1971, had a house nearby. Mum and Durf, who'd finally got married too, moved just down the road and kept an eye on the bungalow when we were away. They call that area of England the Stockbroker Belt, which makes it sound boring and suburban, but it wasn't at all. For one thing, Keith Moon lived 10 minutes away from me, which obviously lent daily life a certain unpredictability. Keith was fabulous, but his diet of chemicals seemed to have left him without any understanding of the concept of time. He'd turn up unannounced at 2:30 in the morning, completely out of his mind, usually with Ringo Starr, another local resident, in tow, and seem genuinely surprised that he'd got you out of bed. Or he'd materialise without warning in your driveway at 7 a.m. on Christmas Day in a Rolls-Royce convertible with the top down and the Shadows' greatest hits playing at deafening volume. Dear boy, look at the new car. Come for a spin. No, now. No need to change out of your dressing gown. But the most interesting person I knew in Virginia Water had nothing to do with the music business. I met Brian Forbes when I walked into the bookshop he owned in the town, looking for something to read. He came over and introduced himself and said that he thought he recognised me. That didn't seem unlikely. By now, my onstage flamboyance had seeped into my everyday wardrobe. So my idea of dressing down for an afternoon shopping in a Surrey commuter town involved wearing a bright orange fur coat and a pair of 8-inch platform boots. But it turned out that he didn't recognise me at all. As the conversation progressed, it became increasingly apparent that he thought I was one of the Bee Gees. Once we'd established that I wasn't a Gibb brother, we got on very well. Brian was fascinating. He'd been an actor and was now a screenwriter, a novelist and a director, and he would go on to become a studio boss. He was married to the actress Nanette Newman, and the two of them seemed to know everybody personally. Hollywood legends, writers, TV stars. If you were in America and expressed a long-held desire to meet David Niven or Groucho Marx, Brian could arrange it. Which is how I ended up with a Marx Brothers film poster signed to John Elton from Marx Groucho. He couldn't understand why my name was, as he put it, the wrong way round. It's funny, I thought of Groucho years later at Buckingham Palace when I got my knighthood, because that's how the Lord Chamberlain announced me to the Queen, Sir John Elton. One summer Sunday afternoon, John and I were sitting outside the bungalow having a snack when we noticed a 60-something lady who looked a little like Katharine Hepburn cycling up our drive. It was Katharine Hepburn. "I'm staying with Brian Forbes. He said it would be okay if I used your pool." John and I just nodded, dumbstruck. 5 minutes later, she reappeared in a swimsuit, complaining that there was a dead frog in the pool. When I dithered about how to get it out, I'm a bit squeamish about things like that, she just jumped in and grabbed it with her hand. I asked her how she could bear to touch it. "Character, young man," she nodded sternly. If you were invited to the Forbes house for lunch, you'd find yourself sitting between Peter Sellers and Dame Edith Evans, drinking in their stories, or you'd turn up to discover that the other guests included the Queen Mother. Brian knew the royal family. He was president of the National Youth Theatre, and Princess Margaret was a patron. It turned out that Princess Margaret loved music and the company of musicians. She ended up inviting me and the band back to Kensington Palace for supper after a gig at the Royal Festival Hall, which turned out to be incredibly awkward. Not because of Princess Margaret, she was really sweet and friendly to everybody, but because of her husband, Lord Snowdon. Everyone knew the marriage was in trouble. There were always rumours in the press about one or the other having an affair, but even so, nothing could have prepared us for his arrival. He stormed in midway through the meal and literally snarled, "Where's my fucking dinner?" at her. They had a huge row, and she fled the room in tears. Me and the band were just sitting there aghast, not really knowing what to do. You know, how bizarre can life in the Elton John band get? Other musicians relax after a gig by smoking a joint or seducing groupies or trashing hotel rooms. we end up watching Princess Margaret and Lord Snowdon screaming at each other. But it wasn't just who Brian knew, it was what he knew, and the fact that he was a born teacher. Patient and generous with his time, sophisticated in his tastes but completely unsnobbish, eager for others to love the things he loved. He taught me about art, and I started collecting under his influence. First it was Art Nouveau and Art Deco posters, which were very fashionable in the early 70s. Rod Stewart collected them too. Then surrealist painters like Paul Wunderlich. I began buying Tiffany lamps and Bugatti furniture. Brian got me interested in theatre and recommended books to me. We became very close and started going on holiday together. Me and John, Brian, Nanette and their daughters Emma and Sarah. We would hire a house in California for a month and friends would come over and visit. Nanette turned out to be a great accomplice when it came to shopping, something I'd become extremely fond of since I started making a bit of money. Actually, that's not strictly true. I've always loved shopping, since I was a kid. When I think of growing up in Pinner, I think of the shops. The different coloured cotton reels in the wool shop where my gran used to get her knitting supplies. The smell of fresh peanuts as you walked into Woolworths. The sawdust on the floor of Sainsbury's where Auntie Wynne worked on the butter counter. I don't know why, but something about those places fascinated me. I've always loved collecting things, and I've always loved buying people presents, more than I love receiving them. When I was a boy, my favourite thing about Christmas was working out what I was going to buy my family. Some aftershave for my dad, a rain hat for my gran, maybe a little vase for my mum from the kiosk near Baker Street Station that I used to pass on my way to the Royal Academy of Music. Of course, becoming successful enabled me to pursue this passion on a slightly different scale. We'd come back from LA with so much stuff that the excess baggage charge would be as much as the ticket home. I'd hear that my Auntie Wynne was feeling down in the dumps, so I'd call a dealership and get them to send her a new car to cheer her up. Over the years, I've had therapists tell me that it's obsessive, addictive behaviour, or that I'm trying to buy people's affection by giving them gifts. With the greatest of respect to the members of the psychiatric profession who have said that sort of thing to me, I think that's a load of old shit. I'm not interested in buying people's affection. I just get a lot of pleasure out of making people feel included or letting them know I'm thinking about them. I love seeing people's faces when you treat them to something. I don't need a psychiatrist to tell me that material possessions aren't a replacement for love or personal happiness. I've spent enough miserable, lonely nights in houses filled with beautiful things to have worked that out for myself a long time ago. And I really don't recommend going shopping in the depressing aftermath of a 3-day cocaine binge unless you want to wake up the next day confronted by bags and bags filled with absolute crap you don't actually remember buying. Or, in my case, you wake up the next morning to a phone call informing you that you've bought a tram. Not a model tram. An actual tram. A Melbourne W2 class drop centre combination tram that the voice at the end of the phone is now informing you has to be shipped from Australia to Britain, where it can only be delivered to your house by hanging it from 2 Chinook helicopters. So I'd be the first person to admit that I've made some fairly rash decisions with a credit card in my hand. I probably could have struggled through life somehow without a tram in my garden, or indeed the full-scale fiberglass model of a Tyrannosaurus Rex that I offered to take off Ringo Starr's hands at the end of a very long night. Ringo was trying to sell his house at the time, and the presence of a full-scale fiberglass Tyrannosaurus Rex in the garden was apparently proving to be a bit of a sticking point with potential buyers. But for as long as I can remember, I've always found collecting things oddly comforting. And I've always enjoyed learning about things by collecting them, whether that's records, or photographs, or clothes, or art. And that's never changed. Regardless of what has been going on in my personal life, I've found it comforting and enjoyable when I felt lonely and adrift. And I've found it comforting and enjoyable when I felt loved and contented and settled. Lots of people feel that way. The world's full of model railway enthusiasts and stamp collectors and vinyl buffs. I'm just lucky enough to have the money to pursue my passions further than most people. I earned that money by working hard, and if people think the way I spend it is excessive or ridiculous, then I'm afraid that's their problem. I don't feel guilty about it at all. If it's an addiction, well, I've been addicted to far more damaging things over the years than buying tableware and photographs. It makes me happy. You know, I've got 1,000 candles in a closet in my home in Atlanta, and I suppose that is excessive. But I'll tell you what, it's the best smelling closet you've ever been in your life. My shopping habit wasn't the only thing that was ramped up a notch. Everything seemed to be getting bigger, louder, more excessive. Bernie and I hadn't intended Rocket Man to be a huge hit single. We saw ourselves as album artists, but that's what it turned into. It was number two in Britain, much higher than any of our singles had reached before, and went triple platinum in the States. We'd stumbled onto a different kind of commerciality, and its success changed our audience. Screaming girls started appearing in the front rows and outside the stage door, tearfully clinging onto the car as we tried to get away. It felt really peculiar. As if they'd gone to see the Osmonds or David Cassidy but taken a wrong turn and somehow ended up at our gig instead. I worked really hard. Maybe too hard, but it felt like there was an unstoppable momentum behind me that carried me on no matter how exhausted I was, that drove me through any kind of setback. I contracted glandular fever just before we went into the studio to record Don't Shoot Me, I'm Only the Piano Player in the summer of 1972. I should have cancelled the sessions in order to recuperate, but I just went to the Chateau de Reveil and ploughed through them, running on adrenaline. You would never have known I was ill from listening to the album. The guys singing Daniel and Crocodile Rock doesn't sound unwell. A few weeks after we finished, I was back on tour again. I kept pushing the live show, trying to make it more over the top and outrageous. I started employing professional costume designers. First Danny Reavy, then Bill Whitten and Bob Mackie, and egging them on to do whatever they wanted, no matter how insane. More feathers, more sequins, brighter colours, bigger platforms. You've designed an outfit covered in multicoloured balls attached to pieces of elastic that glow in the dark? How many balls? Why don't you add some more? I won't be able to play the piano in it. Let me worry about that. Then I got the idea of bringing Legs Larry Smith, who'd been in the Bonzo Dog Doodah band, on tour with us. Legs was a drummer, but his other big talent was tap dancing. When we were making Honky Chateau, we had got him to come to the studio and tap dance on a song called I Think I'm Going to Kill Myself. And now I got him to tap dance on stage as well. His routine got more and more elaborate as the tour went on. Legs came on stage in a crash helmet and the vast train of a wedding dress. Then he started coming on stage accompanied by two dwarfs dressed as US Marines, while confetti rained from the ceiling. Then he came up with a routine where he and I would mime to Singing in the Rain, complete with dialogue. Larry would lean on my piano and sigh at me, "Gee, Elton, I wish I could play like you. I'll bet you get all the boys." As usual, no one even raised an eyebrow. I even invited Larry along when I was asked to do the Royal Variety performance, which caused a huge row. Bernard Delfont, who organised the show, mystifyingly didn't want a man in a wedding train and a crash helmet tap dancing in front of the Queen Mother. I told him to fuck off, that I wouldn't play unless Larry came on. And he eventually relented. I thought it was the best thing about the whole evening, apart from the fact that I got to share a dressing room with Liberace. He'd clearly forgotten about, or forgiven me for, my failure to appear at his London Palladium performance a couple of years before, and was just divine. Like a living embodiment of showbiz. He turned up with trunk after trunk of clothes. I thought I looked pretty outrageous myself. I was dressed in multicoloured Lurex pinstripes with matching platform shoes and a top hat, but by comparison, with his side of the dressing room, mine looked like a particularly dowdy corner of Marks and Spencer. He had a suit covered in tiny bulbs that lit up when he sat at the piano. He signed an autograph for me. His signature was in the shape of a piano. Then spent the afternoon reeling off one fantastic story after another in an impossibly camp accent. The month before, he said the hydraulic platform that raised him up through the stage had broken midway through his grand entrance. Nothing if not a trooper, he'd performed for 40 minutes with only his head visible to the audience. I had become increasingly obsessed with making a big entrance on stage myself, because it was the one time that I was really mobile, when I wasn't stuck behind the piano. It reached a peak when we played the Hollywood Bowl in 1973. The stage was hung with a huge painting of me in top hat and tails, surrounded by dancing girls. First, Tony King came on stage and introduced Linda Lovelace, who was the biggest porn star in the world at the time. Then a succession of lookalikes walked down an illuminated staircase flanked with palm trees at the back of the stage. The Queen, Batman and Robin, Frankenstein's monster, the Pope. Finally, I appeared to the sound of the 20th Century Fox theme, dressed in what I called the incredible cheese straw outfit. It was completely covered in white marabou feathers, the trousers as well as the jacket, and came with a matching hat. As I descended, the lids of five grand pianos sprang open, spelling out Elton. For the benefit of anyone who felt this was too subtle and understated, 400 white doves were meant to fly out of the grand pianos. I don't know whether they were asleep or too frightened to come out, but none appeared. As I jumped on top of my piano, I found myself unexpectedly joined on stage by John Reed, who, judging by his furious expression, seemed to have taken the doves' non-appearance as a personal insult, as if they'd done it deliberately to challenge his managerial authority. And a more sheepish-looking Bernie, running from one piano to the next, frantically grabbing doves and throwing them into the air. Dance routines, marabou feathers, doves flying, or not, as the case may be, out of grand pianos with my name on the lids. The band didn't like this kind of thing much, and nor did Bernie. He thought it was distracting attention from the music. I thought I was forging myself into a personality that was like nobody else in rock, and besides, I was having fun. We would have these preposterous disagreements about it. The biggest songwriting partnership of the era locked in a dispute backstage at the Santa Monica Civic, not about money or musical direction, but about whether it was a good idea for me to go on stage with an illuminated model of Father Christmas hanging in front of my willy. Sometimes Bernie had a point. The costumes literally did affect the music. I had a pair of glasses made in the shape of the word Elton with lights all over them. The combined weight of the glasses and the battery pack that powered the lights squashed my nostrils so that it sounded like I was singing while holding my nose. In fairness, that probably did undercut the emotional impact of his lovingly crafted lyrics. The Hollywood Bowl show was a huge event, a kind of launch for my next album, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. By my standards, at least, its making had been slightly torturous. We had decamped to Dynamic Sound Studios in Kingston, Jamaica. It was considered very hip in those days to go and make your album somewhere more exotic than Europe. Dynamic Sounds had seemed like an obvious destination. Bob Marley had recorded there. So had Cat Stevens. It was where the Rolling Stones had made Goat's Head Soup. But we arrived to find there was a record pressing plant attached to the studio, and the pressing plant workers were on strike. When you arrived, they would pull open the windows of the minibus that brought us from our hotel and spit crushed fiberglass at everyone inside with blowpipes, which brought you out in a rash. Once you got into the studio itself, nothing worked. You'd ask for a different microphone and someone would nod slowly and say, we can get one in maybe 3 days. It was hopeless. I've no idea how the Rolling Stones made an album there. Maybe Keith was so stoned that 3 days wait for a working microphone felt like 20 minutes. Eventually we gave up, went back to the hotel and called to book recording sessions at the Chateau d'Arreville. While we were waiting for a plane out of there, the band sat by the pool, occupying themselves with what appeared to be some kind of determined world record attempt involving the consumption of marijuana. By the time we got to the Chateau, we had so many songs that Goodbye Yellow Brick Road ended up a double album. When it came out, it took off in a way that none of us expected. It's quite a dark record in a lot of ways. Songs about sadness and disillusion, songs about alcoholics and prostitutes and murders. A song about a 16-year-old lesbian who ends up dead in a subway. But it just kept selling and selling and selling until I couldn't work out who was still buying it. I don't mean that flippantly. I really didn't know who was buying it. The American record company kept pushing me to release Benny and the Jets as a single, and I fought them tooth and nail. It's a really odd song. It doesn't sound like anything else I've done. It's 5 minutes long. Why don't you just put out Candle in the Wind like we've done in Britain? Then they told me it was being played all over black radio stations in Detroit. When they released it, it shot up the Billboard Soul chart. An unreal thing, seeing my name in among the singles by Eddie Kendricks and Gladys Knight and Barry White. I may not have been the first white artist to do that, but I can say with some certainty that I was the first artist from Pinner. I was now so successful that I toured America using the Starship, an old Boeing 720 passenger plane that had been converted into an opulent flying tour bus for the exclusive use of the 70s rock and roll elite. There were lurid tales about the parties Led Zeppelin had thrown on it. I was less bothered about what they'd done inside it than what they'd done to the outside of it. The thing was painted purple and gold. It looked like a giant box of milk tray with wings. No problem. We could have it repainted to our specification. It was redone in red and blue with white stars. Much more tasteful. Inside, the Starship had a bar decorated in orange and gold foil with a long mirror behind it. An organ, dining table, sofas, and a TV with a video recorder on which my mother insisted on watching Deep Throat. Well, everyone's talking about it, aren't they? What's it about then? While she was eating her lunch. Whatever foul deeds Led Zeppelin had got up to on board, I'm pretty sure they never kept themselves amused for an hour watching a middle-aged lady shriek with horror while Linda Lovelace did her thing. Oh, gold, no, what's happening now? Oh, I can't look. How's she doing that? There was a bedroom at the back with a shower, a fake fireplace and a bedside table made of plexiglass. You could hide yourself away in there and have sex. Or sulk, which is what I was doing one night when my American publicist, Sharon Lawrence, started knocking on the door and pleading with me to come out. Come back to the bar, we've got a surprise for you. I told her to fuck off. She kept coming back. I kept telling her to fuck off. Eventually she burst into tears.
You have to come to the bar, you have to, you have to.
So I angrily opened the door and did as she asked, with a lot of huffing and eye-rolling and, for fuck's sake, can't you leave me alone-ing en route. When I got to the bar, Stevie Wonder was sitting at the organ, ready to play for me. He launched into Happy Birthday. Had I not been cruising at 40,000 feet, I'd have prayed for the ground to open and swallow me. From the outside, everything looked perfect. The tours were getting bigger and more spectacular. The records were selling so much that journalists had started to say I was the biggest pop artist in the world. John had taken over my management completely. The contract he had signed with DJM in 1971 had run out, and he had moved out of his offices and started his own management company. We had also started our own record company with Bernie and Gus Dudgeon called Rocket. Not to release my records, but to find talent and give them a break. Sometimes we were better at spotting talent than developing it. We couldn't make a success of a band called Long Dancer, despite the fact that their guitarist, a teenager called Dave Stewart, clearly had something about him, as was proven years later when he formed Eurythmics. But we had successes too. We signed Kiki D, who John and I had known for years. She had been the only white British artist signed to Motown when John worked for them. She had been putting out singles since the early 60s, but never had a hit until we released her version of Amoureuse, a song by a French singer called Véronique Sanson that had flopped in the UK, but that Tony King had noticed and suggested to Kiki. But beneath the surface, things were starting to go wrong. We spent the first weeks of 1974 recording at the Caribou Ranch, a studio up in the Rocky Mountains that gave its name to our new album, Caribou. It could be hard to sing at such a high altitude, which is how I ended up throwing a tantrum while we were recording Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. After announcing that I hated the song so much we were going to stop recording it immediately and send it to Engelbert Humperdinck, and if he doesn't want it, tell him to send it to Lulu, she can put it on a B-side. I was coaxed back to the vocal booth and completed the take. Then I yelled at Gus Dudgeon that I hated it even more now it was finished and was going to kill him with my bare hands if he put it on the album. Apart from that, it was great up at Caribou. The studio was much plusher than the chateau. You stayed in beautiful log cabins filled with antiques. The bed I slept in was supposed to have belonged to Grover Cleveland, a 19th century president of the United States. There was a screening room for movies, and musicians passing through Denver or Boulder would drop by to visit. Having obviously forgiven me for the incident on the Starship, Stevie Wonder turned up one day and took out a snowmobile, insisting on driving it himself. To preempt your question, no. I have absolutely no idea how Stevie Wonder successfully piloted a snowmobile through the Rocky Mountains of Colorado without killing himself, or indeed anyone else, in the process. But he did. One night we were finishing up when I wandered into a room at the back of the studio and spotted John fiddling with something on a table. He had a straw and some white powder. I asked what it was and he told me it was cocaine. I asked what it did and he said, "Oh, it just makes you feel good." So I asked if I could have some and he said yes. The first line I snorted made me retch. I hated the feeling in the back of my throat, that weird combination of numbness brought on by the drug itself and a sort of powdery dryness from whatever crap the coke had been cut with. I couldn't get rid of it no matter how often I swallowed. I went out to the toilet and threw up. And then I immediately went back into the room where John was and asked for another line. What the hell was I doing? I tried it. I hated it. It made me puke. Hello! Talk about God's way of telling you to leave it at that. It's hard to see how I could have been given a clearer warning that this was a bad idea unless it had started raining brimstone and I'd been visited by a plague of boils. So why didn't I leave it at that? Partly because throwing up didn't stop the coke affecting me and I liked how it made me feel. That jolt of confidence and euphoria, the sense that I could suddenly open up, that I didn't feel shy or intimidated, that I could talk to anybody. That was all bullshit, of course. I was full of energy, I was inquisitive, I had a sense of humour and a thirst for knowledge. I didn't need a drug to make me talk to people. If anything, cocaine gave me too much confidence for my own good. If I hadn't been coked out of my head when the Rolling Stones turned up in Colorado and asked me to come on stage with them, I might have just performed Honky Tonk Women, waved to the crowd and made my exit. Instead, I decided it was going so well, I'd stay on and jam along to the rest of their set, without first taking the precaution of asking the Stones if they wanted an auxiliary keyboard player. For a while, I thought Keith Richards kept staring at me because he was awestruck by the brilliance of my improvised contributions to their oeuvre. After a few songs, it finally penetrated my brain that the expression on his face wasn't really suggestive of profound musical appreciation. Actually, he looked remarkably like someone who was about to inflict appalling violence on a musician who'd outstayed his welcome. I quickly scuttled off, noting as I went that Keith was still staring at me in a manner that suggested we'd be discussing this later, and decided it might be best if I didn't hang around for the after-show party. But there was something more to cocaine than the way it made me feel. Cocaine had a certain cachet about it. It was fashionable and exclusive. Doing it was like becoming a member of an elite little clique that secretly indulged in something edgy, dangerous and illicit. Pathetically enough, that really appealed to me. I'd become successful and popular, but I never felt cool. Even back in Bluesology, I was the nerdy one, the one who didn't look like a pop star, who never quite carried off the hip clothes, who spent all his time in record shops while the rest of the band were out getting laid and taking drugs. And cocaine felt cool. The subtly coded conversations to work out who had some or who wanted some, who was part of the clique and who wasn't. The secretive visits to the bathrooms of clubs and bars. Of course, that was all bullshit too. I already was part of a club. Ever since my solo career had begun, I'd been shown nothing but kindness and love by other artists. From the minute I turned up in LA, musicians I adored and worshipped, to people who'd just been mythic names on album sleeves and record labels, had fallen over themselves to offer friendship and support. But when it finally arrived, my success had happened so fast that despite the warm welcome, I couldn't help but still feel slightly out of place, as if I didn't quite belong. As it turned out, doing a line of coke, then immediately going back for another one was very me. I was never the kind of drug addict who couldn't get out of bed without a line, or who needed to take it every day. But once I started, I couldn't stop until I was absolutely certain there was no cocaine anywhere in the vicinity. I realised quite quickly that I had to get someone else, a PA or a roadie, to look after my coke for me, not because I was too grand or too scared to be the stash holder, but because if you left me in charge of that evening's supply of cocaine, there would be none of it left by tea time. My appetite for the stuff was unbelievable, enough to attract comment in the circles I was moving in. Given that I was a rock star spending a lot of time in 70s LA, this was not an inconsiderable feat. Once again, you might think this would have given me pause for thought, but I'm afraid the next 16 years were full of incidents that would have given any rational human being pause concerning their drug consumption, as we shall discover. That was the problem. Because I was doing coke, I wasn't a rational human being anymore. You might tell yourself you're fine, using as evidence the fact that your drug use isn't affecting your career. But you can't take that amount of coke and think in a sane and proper way. You become unreasonable and irresponsible, self-obsessed, a law unto yourself. It's your way or the highway. It's a horrible fucking drug. I'd made the worst decision of my life, but I didn't realise it then. By contrast, the problems in my relationship with John were staring me in the face. I said before that I was incredibly naive about gay relationships. One thing I didn't know was that John thought it was perfectly acceptable to have sex with other people behind my back. Open relationships are a lot more common among gay men than straight couples, but that's not what I wanted. I was in love. When he realised that, it didn't stop him being promiscuous, it just made him dishonest about it. That led to some really humiliating scenes. John vanished during a party at the director John Schlesinger's house in LA. I went looking for him and found him upstairs in bed with someone. My mum rang me up on tour to tell me that she'd popped round to the house in Virginia Water and discovered John was hosting a sex party in my absence. I'd confront him. There'd be a huge row. Things would calm down, then he'd go and do exactly the same thing again. Or worse, he'd come up with some new variant on sleeping around that seemed designed to send me even more hysterical. I found out he'd gone to a film premiere, picked up a famous TV actress and started an affair with her. Her! So now he was fucking women as well. What was I supposed to do about that particular twist in our relationship? It went on and on and on, and it was miserable. I seemed to spend half my life in tears over his behaviour, but it made absolutely no difference. So why didn't I leave him? Partly it was out of love. I'd fallen head over heels for John, and when you're like that with someone who cheats, you'll make any excuse for them. Over and over again, kid yourself that this time they really mean it, and from now on it's going to be okay. And in his own way, John really did love me. He was just completely incapable of keeping his dick in his pants if left to his own devices. I also stayed because I was scared of him. John had a temper that could easily spill over into violence, especially if he'd been drinking or doing coke. Sometimes his rages were unwittingly funny. I'd ring the offices of Rocket and ask to speak to him. Oh, he's not here. He lost his temper and tried to throw an electric typewriter down the stairs, but it was still plugged in, so that didn't really work, which made him even more angry. So he fired the entire staff and stormed out. We're just wondering whether we should go home or not. But most of the time, they weren't funny at all. I watched John threaten someone with a broken glass at a party hosted by Billy Gaff, Rod Stewart's manager. He hit a doorman outside a hotel in San Francisco after an argument about parking a car. He punched a sound engineer in front of a room full of American journalists at the launch of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. When we were touring in New Zealand in 1974, he threw a glass of wine in the face of the local record label promotions guy when the party they'd thrown for me ran out of whiskey. When a female reporter from a local paper tried to intervene, he punched her in the face. Later the same night, at a different party, I got into an argument with another local journalist over the earlier incident, which I hadn't actually seen happen. John came flying across the room, knocked him to the floor, and started kicking him. The next morning, we were both arrested and charged with assault. I was acquitted, charged $50 costs, paid up, and got out of New Zealand as quickly as possible. I left without John, who had his appeal for bail turned down and was eventually sentenced to 28 days in Mount Eden prison. I flew home without him. His behaviour was completely indefensible. But it was an era in which the line between tough guy, rock manager, and thug was frequently blurred. Look at Peter Grant and Led Zeppelin. And as I waited in on a Saturday night for his weekly call from prison, I somehow managed to construct a version of events in my head where he was the injured party, acting nobly in my defence, aided by his claim that the female journalist had called him a puff before he hit her. As if that justified it. It wasn't until John hit me that I came to my senses. It happened the night we threw a fancy dress party at Hercules. I can't even remember what the argument was about, probably the latest episode in John's catalogue of cheating. But it started before the guests even got there and became more and more heated. There was shouting, doors were slammed, and a beautiful Art Deco mirror that Charlie Watts from the Rolling Stones had given us got smashed. Then John dragged me into the bathroom and punched me in the face. Hard. I reeled backwards. I was so shocked I didn't retaliate. He stormed out and I looked in the bathroom mirror. My nose was bleeding and my face was cut. I cleaned myself up and the party went ahead as if nothing had happened. Everyone had a great time. Durf turned up in drag. Tony King arrived completely covered in gold paint like Shirley Eaton in Goldfinger. But something had happened, and to me it felt like a switch had finally been flicked off. I couldn't make excuses for John's behaviour any longer. I couldn't stay with someone who hit me. I really don't think John expected me to tell him it was over. Even after he moved out to a house on Montpellier Square in Knightsbridge, and I asked my mum and Durf to help me find a place to live on my own, I literally didn't have time to go house hunting myself, I think he was still in love with me. I got the sense that if I'd asked him to come back, he would have been there like a shot. But I didn't want him back. I wanted him to stay as my manager, but everything else about our relationship had changed. The balance of power had shifted. Until then, he'd been the dominant personality. But after we broke up as a couple, I became more confident and assertive. He took on other acts as a manager, not just musicians, comedians like Billy Connolly and Barry Humphreys. But our business relationship still worked because I knew how astute he was and how great his ear was for music. One morning at the offices in South Audley Street, he said he wanted to play me something by one of his new clients that was going to be a huge hit all over the world. We listened to the song and I shook my head incredulous. "You're not actually going to release that, are you?" He frowned. What's wrong with it?" "Well, for one thing, it's about 3 hours long. For another, it's the campest thing I've ever heard in my life. And the title's absolutely ridiculous as well." John was completely unfazed. "I'm telling you no," he said, lifting the test pressing of Bohemian Rhapsody off the turntable. "That is going to be one of the biggest records of all time." But if Queen's most famous song sailed over my head at first, I got Freddie Mercury straight away. From the minute I met him, I loved him. As was tradition, he got given a drag name, Melina, after Melina Mercouri, the Greek actress. He was just magnificent. Incredibly smart and adventurous, kind and generous and thoughtful, but outrageously funny. Oh, God, if you went out clubbing with him and Tony King, they were great friends, you'd spend the whole night howling. No one was spared, not even the other members of Queen. "Have you seen the guitarist, darling? Mrs. May, have you seen what she wears on stage? Clogs. Fucking clogs. Oh, how did I end up on stage with a guitarist who wears fucking clogs?" And not Michael Jackson, who Freddie called Mahalia. A name I don't think Michael found anywhere near as hilarious as Freddie did. He had incurred Freddie's wrath by trying to interest him in his menagerie of animals. And Freddie had turned retelling the story into a tour de force performance that rivaled anything he did on stage. Oh, darling, that dreadful llama. All the way to California to see Mrs. Jackson, and she leads me out into the garden, and there's the llama. Then she asks me to help get it back into its pen. I was wearing a white suit and I got covered in mud. And eventually I had to shout at her, "Oh, for fuck's sake, Mahalia, get your fucking llama away from me." "Ugh," he would add, shuddering for comic effect. "It was a nightmare, darling.